Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Long before American politics and entertainment merged in the form of the Trump White House, my guest Mark Leibovich chronicled the uneasy relationship between elected officials, media figures, and lobbyists in this town. Now he is back with a new book about America's other leading religion, football. Leibovich, a Patriots fan, had uncommon access to the league's owners, commissioner, and players over the past few seasons as the NFL confronted concussions, social protest, and team relocation. His new book is called Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Mark Leibovich, welcome to the roundtable.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
So you thought you'd take a little break from politics, and politics followed you into football. But why did you want to focus on the NFL in this project?
Well, I mean that's sort of the answer. Essentially, I needed a little bit of a break. I mean, the 2016 campaign was quite grueling, and I've been doing this for about 15, 16 years. And I love football. I also became sort of fascinated by how the empire just seemed to be so prosperous, but also so precarious at the same time. And it just seemed like a really interesting time to just jump in and immerse myself for a few years. And I was stunned by how easy it was to get into that world, and just how easy it was to talk to some of these people. And you do get a sense of an empire, just maybe, if not on its last days, certainly a nervous empire. And that's sort of what football is.
What are some of the ways, in your mind, that football finds itself in a precarious position here as we speak at the beginning of the 2018 season?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of different sort of existential issues. Existential is a word you hear a lot around the league these days. One of them is health and safety. I mean, there's the question of, you know, is football ever going to be safe at any speed? And are the cultural changes that we're seeing and demographic changes that we're seeing conducive to the kind of explosive growth and popularity that football has already had, that always had? I mean, youth participation rates are down. There's obviously a lot greater awareness of concussion and brain injury. And, you know, I think it sort of puts a pall over the whole game in some ways. But also, look, I mean, football has always been an escape. It's been marketed as such. And now the culture wars have sort of taken up shop, you know, full on in the NFL. And largely, you know, Donald Trump has made it part of his reality show. And in a way, these two sort of reality shows, football and politics and Trump, were destined to collide. And they did. It's like this American carnage in any number of directions.
It's interesting because he's obviously used the kneeling issue as a political cudgel, but you write that his history with the league in close relationships with many of the owners, but also his desire to be among them as an owner really stretches back decades.
Yeah, the NFL is sort of a classic nose pressed against the glass institution for Donald Trump. They wanted no part of him over four decades. He's tried repeatedly to get a team, and as fate would have it, I mean, the ultimate consolation prize is a ticket to the White House, right? So there he is, like, sort of heckling from the White House. But no, there's obviously a lot of history there, and the owners, many of whom supported his campaign and gave a lot of money to it, and gave a lot of money to his inauguration fund, really have no idea what to do with him now. I mean, he's sort of intent on putting himself squarely in the middle of another season.
All right, let's talk about some of the figures you focus on, beginning with the commissioner, Roger Goodell. He makes an obscene amount of money. He loves working out. Those are two things I took away from your book.
Yes, he does. Yes, but I mean, two very good takeaways. The commissioner, Roger Goodell, but look, I never thought I was going to get to spend time with him. I did a few interviews with him. He's about as interesting and as scripted in person as he is up on a podium. But he, one thing he loved to talk about was, like, how many hours he worked out that day. And this is a guy who, you know, he's fun to talk to only just because he's such a it's so much fun to try to get him off his talking points, and he doesn't really have a sense of humor. But also, he is a politician. He's a politician's son. His father was a Republican senator from New York, and he, his job is basically to keep 32 really, really rich, largely white guys happy, the 32 owners, and that's sort of where he focuses in his energies, which is basically making a bunch of billionaires even more money than they had.
Now, every time he approaches a podium in public, he's booed mercilessly by the fans. But how is he doing as a commissioner?
Well, I mean, the only constituency that matters, to him at least, are the 32 owners, the people who pay him, the people who allow him to continue. And look, I mean, it's a trade association, basically, a glorified and very peculiar trade association in which if he can make money for the 32 members, or membership, as they call themselves, of the club, he's doing a good job in their eyes, and he can continue to do it. Now, when you get to public opinion, Roger Goodell is I wouldn't even call him a polarizing figure, because most people just really don't like him. He's very unpopular among fans, among players. And I was sort of amused at all the techniques the league tried to use to try to get him less booed at the draft every year. But he just continues to go out, and every draft pick he reads off for seven rounds, he's going to be booed lustily. So in a way, he's become this almost Vince McMahon-like villain, like the guy at the top of the organizational chart that everyone resents.
Okay, another person a lot of people resent, although maybe not in our listening area, is Tom Brady of the Patriots, who's had this sustained run of excellence. He's probably the greatest quarterback ever. And you struck up an email correspondence with him and were able to stay in touch over a period of a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I should tell you, by way of transparency, I was one of these people who I'd still root for the Patriots. I grew up in that area, and even though I live in Washington, D.C. now, I mean, it's hard to kick that disease, or you know, it's true of any sports team you take an allegiance to. But yes, my day job is politics, but I always had a bit of a side project for the last few years to try to get to Tom Brady and see if he'd be interested in talking to me for a magazine story for the Times Magazine. Ultimately, somehow that happened, and he agreed to do it, and it all started with an email from him that just said simply, "Tom Brady here." And I was like, yeah, I'm Santa Claus. But, it's as it happened, I went and I visited with him at his place in New York City and then his place in Massachusetts and did a story, and we kind of kept in touch over the years. So he became one of the characters in the book, and just so happened that in the course of my reporting, he went to three Super Bowls, won two of them, and was also in the middle of one of the most absurd sports scandals in history, Deflategate.
Tell us about Deflategate, because you make the point that it was, you know, it was one of these minor scandals that the league probably blew up into something much bigger, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, it's really weird. I mean, it was, first of all, it was the dominant sort of off-season story for maybe 2 years running, right? But in a way, it was so, so ridiculous. And obviously, you know, there are people who disagree. They think it's the worst cheating scandal in history. I totally disagree with that. But no, I mean, look, it was nothing. It was a couple of maybe inches of air pressure that, like, no one could tell the difference of by touching a football. He may or may not have been involved. And yet, I mean, basically, this was almost appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. It took up, you know, tens of millions of dollars and hours and men and women hours. But what was interesting was it was a goofy story that had nothing to do with domestic violence. I mean, the year before, the Ray Rice domestic violence scandal and this horrible video of him knocking out his fiancée on an elevator, it was like the predominant story, and that was not pleasant, and concussions is not a pleasant story, and all of a sudden the NFL, I doubt they're smart enough to figure this out, but they have this really, really weird sort of scandal in the middle of all of this that everyone's focused on. And, it also involved the league's most despised and resented team, a very easy-to-hate superstar. And it had all the elements, and somehow it took up a lot of people's attention, including mine. And I'm not proud of all the time management I wasted over that year listening to sports radio and waiting for the truth to emerge.
Give us a sense of Tom Brady and your dealings with him. We know he's hyper-obsessed about peak performance, maybe with a touch of quackery involved there. And yet he's sort of been able to stay at the very top of his game well past the expiration date.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's 41 years old. He continues to play at a really, really high level. And he's an extremely sort of counterintuitive thinker and doer as far as training and diet. And, I mean, he talks about things and trains in ways that normal, NFL players outside, inside the kind of NFL industrial complex of science and medicine do. So I always found that interesting. I mean, the quackery you mentioned, I mean, he's given a lot of power and authority to Alex Guerrero, who is his sort of body coach and guru and the godfather to his son. I mean, so there's a bit of a weird sort of alter ego, almost Yoko Ono quality, where a lot of the people think that, okay, he's coming between him and the team, and he, our hero is getting all weird and everything. But look, I really like Tom Brady. I liked talking to him. I think he's really interesting. I think he's extremely one-dimensionally focused on football, as many people who are passionate about their craft are. And I ultimately, I mean, despite, the fact that he's not the most accessible person in the world, as far as I don't think I'll ever be able to be or look or live like him. I found him to be a very decent and sort of solid, if somewhat private and shy guy.
We're speaking with Mark Leibovich, and he's the author of the new book, Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. You alluded a moment ago to the concussion question that looms over every NFL season now, and a lot of the reporting in your book concerns former greats who are now hobbled as they walk around the Hall of Fame in Canton and so on. And it raises the question that I think a lot of thinking sports fans are grappling with today, which is, should I watch this game on Sundays knowing 10, 15 years from now that star running back might not be able to walk anymore?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the NFL, I think, is rightly worried about these, you know, thinking football fans. I mean, those who you know, are not able to completely turn off their awareness to just the action on the field. And so, yeah, I mean, I do think they are losing quite a few fans who really can't abide that and who are actually who can't sort of shake the moral dilemma that it takes around that if you're going to experience football and watch football and enjoy football, I mean, the toll it is taking. Now, the other view is these people know exactly what they're getting into. There's enough research and information out there that people can make their own decisions. But look, at the same time, I think we've seen again and again that football is unsafe at any speed. And while you can make some kind of innovation around, you know, equipment or helmets or maybe some rule changes, ultimately, people keep getting bigger and stronger and faster in this league, and you know, people are going to keep getting hurt. So I think that, look, I think the league, at the very least, would like to try to put this moral dilemma, if not on hold, at least maybe slow it down a little bit to a point where, you know, the addiction that this culture has with football just sort of persists into the future, and hopefully we can learn to sort of let these impulses coexist.
Well, there have been a lot of observations about a coming end to football as we know it. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, I'm not one of the doomsayers. I mean, I certainly, there are sort of two schools of thought on this. One is the Malcolm Gladwell school of thought that says 25 years from now, no one will be playing football. It will be very much, you know, close to obsolete, if not obsolete in general. Then there's the other view that you know, football will be here forever, and if it doesn't survive, America will not survive. I'm somewhere in the middle. I think to this point, I have, I guess punt might be the operative metaphor. I have sort of decided that football has again and again, through any number of existential crises over the decades, has survived largely in spite of itself. And I guess I've come to the conclusion, having seen just the numbers they put up every year, I mean, 70 of the top 100 rated TV shows in 2017 were all football games. I mean, those are just extraordinary numbers. I think football will survive in spite of itself. I think it'll also survive in spite of a lot of the people who run and own it. And, you know, I found them in the course of my reporting, and this is all in Big Game. I mean, a quite unimpressive and somewhat clueless lot of people, but they have a great game and a cash cow that they're promoting. So that helps a lot.
I want to talk to you about some media ethics questions. You had access to a lot of people who don't give a lot of on-the-record interviews. You always had a PR flack sitting right by. And I wonder if any of the sources in your book, during this era when we're having very fierce national debate over what's on the record, what's off the record, who can be anonymous, mm-hmm. who can't be, how do you manage a message, and so on, have the sources in your book had any regrets about, you know, drinking scotch with you on a bus, you know, like Jerry Jones did?
Yeah, I haven't heard anything. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time with politicians, and it almost always involves an intermediary and a, you know, PR person usually babysitting the interview and sort of trying to your gatekeepers. There's always like a whole song and dance you have to go through to get to these people. In this case, I don't think it's that complicated. I mean, look, if you're on the record, you're on the record. If you're explicitly off the record, you are explicitly off the record. And I'm not going to, you know, that's sacrosanct. I'm not going to print anything. It didn't happen. I mean, we're just two people talking. I try to avoid that, but that's, you know, something that's going to happen inevitably in the course of transactions like this. Look, I haven't heard from anyone who regrets talking to me, but I also think that a lot of these owners, especially, I mean, Robert Kraft of the New England Patriots, Jerry Jones, you mentioned, of the Dallas Cowboys, and a few others, I think they're used to dealing with sports writers who look for different things, who listen for different things. And also, I think, are used to being afforded a certain level of deference. I mean, one thing I found within the club of the NFL owners is an expectation, sort of a quiet and unspoken expectation, that we will take care of them. And that's sort of the clubby aspect of the sports journalism, such as it is in football and the league. It's all sort of the same swamp. And I saw the same thing in Washington. And the overlaps between these two empires are fascinating because the media is a big part of this club. And you can sort of see these broadcasters for ESPN or NBC or whatever, you know, and they're going to be more widely recognized than most, you know, quarterbacks or coaches in the NFL if they walk through O'Hare Airport. So I remember you mentioned the Canton, Ohio Hall of Fame thing. I mean, you there was like this, all these gold jackets, these Hall of Famers, and the biggest crowds were, I remember seeing the biggest crowd of people looking for autographs were around Chris Berman of ESPN. So, look, the media stars in many ways are also public figures in football, but I was an outsider, and I think that that helps in a case like this. And do they have regrets? Probably, but, you know, none of them have contacted me, and none of them are claiming to be misquoted or anything. So I feel, you know, fine about what I was able to get.
It struck me reading the book that it all comes down to, no matter how many private jets or, you know, girlfriends who are 40 years younger or whatever, that right. This is just kind of a passion play to stoke egos for people who live in a different, you know, stratosphere than the rest of us.
Yeah, I could never understand it. I suspect most of our listeners can't. Yeah, Steve Tisch, the co-owner of the New York Giants, calls it junior high school for billionaires. And I'd even go lower. I mean, you go to these owners' meeting, and it's almost like summer camp. I remember the first owners' meeting, league meeting I went to was in Boca Raton, at the Boca Raton Resort and Club in Boca Raton. And a lot of the owners were complaining because it was not up to snuff. And, you know, to me, it's like a five-star resort. I mean, I don't stay in places like this. I thought it was beautiful. But they were upset because they usually go to the Breakers in Palm Beach, which is a much nicer place. And a couple of them were complaining about that, and there were too many kids running around, and there were not enough places to hide. And it's that, to me, became one of the revelations in reporting Big Game, which is just, I think, how undertold the story of NFL owners is in this club of 32 people who are so suspicious of each other and yet so kind of given to this omerta and this sort of secret society in which, you know, a lot of their books are private. They don't have to tell a lot of secrets. Many of them are used to either total deference or total privacy. And, also, these are some of the most, you know, important and powerful entertainment magnates in our country. And you sort of wonder, wow, how did they get here? Because many of them are just really, really smaller than life. And getting to know them and sort of seeing how they operate both in person and also just sort of as these regal figures who are sort of afforded this incredible respect and esteem was fascinating to me.
Our time is very short, but you can give a one-word answer to this. Has this project made you more or less likely to watch the NFL this season?
Depends. I actually don't know. I'm curious to see how I respond this year. I'm a little sick of it, but I also watched a good portion of the Falcons and Eagles game. I'll probably watch again this weekend.
We've been speaking with Mark Leibovich. He's the author of Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Mark, I love the book, and it's been a pleasure to have a chance to ask you about it.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.